Mr. Speaker.
Order, order.
When Benjamin Franklin said nothing is certain except death and taxes, it was back in the 18th century, well before foreign trusts and tax havens, about which there was a great deal of uncertainty in the House this week. Questions arising from international media reports based on a huge spill of documents from a Panamanian law firm, Mossack Fonseca, containing allegations that New Zealand was a tax haven, elicited this response from Prime Minister John Key in Tuesday's Question Time.
Mr. Speaker, New Zealand is not a tax haven. Tax havens don't have the disclosure regimes that New Zealand have.
Mr. Key's assertion did not convince New Zealand First Leader Winston Peters.
Why are so many international commentators and now the Australians having a go at us for being, in their words, a tax haven?
Right. The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Well, as the member knows, people throw around all sorts of comments, but New Zealand is not a tax haven.
Mr. Key's Deputy and Finance Minister, Bill English, also dismissed the opposition's concerns when answering more questions from Mr. Peters on Thursday.
He's giving a misleading impression that somehow this discussion about foreign trust is to do with New Zealand taxes and what people pay here. It is not. It's nothing to do with the New Zealand tax base, which is among the most comprehensive and best organised in the developed world.
Submit a question.
Supplementary question, Right Honourable Winston Peters.
Why, Minister, when the growing scandal is about us being a tax haven, is he seeking to use every other detour or roadblock to not answer the question?
Honourable Bill English on behalf of the Prime Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, we're not a tax haven. It's really only the opposition parties in New Zealand who are claiming that.
As well as questions from all three main opposition parties, there was this request on Tuesday from Greens co-leader James Shaw.
Mr. Speaker, I seek leave to introduce a members' bill in my name that would end the secrecy around foreign trusts in New Zealand by imposing a registration and disclosure scheme on foreign trusts to be set down as members' order of the day number one.
Our leave is sought for that purpose. Is there any objection?
There was, and the Prime Minister explained the reason for it in response to a question from Mr. Shaw's finance spokeswoman, Julianne Genter.
The government's not opposed to making changes and would continue to work with the OECD on base erosion and the likes. But if the member really thinks that we're going to adopt the members' bill that wants to actually name taxpayers' IRD numbers, for instance, the member's got to be barking mad if she thinks that information should be in the public domain.
That drew a protest from Ms. Genter's other co-leader, Materia Ture.
Point of order, sir.
Point of order,
Materia. That insult was personal and unnecessary, and I ask that he be required to withdraw and apologise for that.
On this occasion, I don't agree with the member.
The Speaker, David Carter, tried to end the lengthy exchange of points of order that followed by inviting Julianne Genter to stand and say if she was offended by the Prime Minister's suggestions that she might be barking mad.
I'm not offended. I'm more disappointed that the Prime Minister won't answer a reasonable question.
The Speaker was then asked to decide whether to accept requests from Mr. Peters and Opposition Leader Andrew Little for an urgent debate on the tax haven allegations.
The making of allegations can never constitute a particular case of recent occurrence for which there is ministerial responsibility. The government is accountable for concerns raised about the alleged use of New Zealand as a tax haven, but this is an ongoing matter. To warrant an urgent debate being held, there must be a new situation or decision of importance in itself. The absence of action on the part of the government is not a particular case of recent occurrence under which an urgent debate can be sought. The application is therefore declined.
Next day, there was another request for a snap debate, this time from the Greens.
I have received a letter from James Shaw seeking to debate under Standing Order 389, the announcement today of a proposal to sell 45% of Kiwibank to ACC and the Superfund.
Although this was a case of recent occurrence, Mr. Carter noted that it wasn't a done deal and in any case, Kiwibank would remain in government ownership. And there was another reason for declining the request.
And finally, there is an opportunity to debate the performance and current operations of New Zealand Post during the upcoming the annual review debate.
The annual review debate is scheduled for next week, but there will be another debate on Kiwibank when a members' bill comes up for its second reading after being reported back to the chamber, apparently by coincidence, on Wednesday.
A select committee report has been delivered for presentation.
Report of the Finance and Expenditure Committee on the Keep Kiwibank Bill.
That bill is set down for second reading.
A members' bill designed to prevent privatisation of Kiwibank without support of 75% or more of MPs or after a public referendum is in the name of Labor's spokesman on state-owned enterprises, David Parker, who, minutes later, was putting this question to Finance Minister Bill English.
Is the government willing to implement mechanisms that would prevent the on-sale of Kiwibank shares by ACC or the super fund to non-public shareholders so as to avoid today's step leading to the privatisation of Kiwibank in the future?
The Honourable Bill English.
Mr Speaker, yes, part of the transaction is that there'll be a right of first refusal, which means that when ACC or the super fund decide to sell their shares, they must first offer them to the government of the day. And I can confirm for the member that the policy of this government would be that if the shares were offered to this government, we would buy them.
It might have to if Mr Parker's bill retains the support of the Maori Party and United Futures' Peter Dunn. Their votes gave the opposition the bedrock majority of 61 to defeat the 60 of Nationaland Act, to give the bill a first reading and send it to the Finance and Expenditure Committee, which, reflecting its dominance by National MPs who occupy 7 of its 12 seats, has recommended it not proceed. The bill joins the queue on the members' order paper, which had a last-minute addition on Wednesday, to exempt RSAs from having to get a special licence to serve alcohol after their dawn parades in time for this Anzac Day on April the 25th. That was put through all its stages on Wednesday with unanimous support, while a private bill in the name of Nick Smith, enabling the transfer of assets and property from the Associated Churches of Christ Trust Board to the Christian Churches New Zealand Property Trust Board, received a third and final reading. Members' Day on Wednesday restricted the time available for debate on government bills, which was largely taken up with the committee stage of the Maori Language Bill, covering some 3.5 hours on Tuesday and Thursday, and ending in a decision to acknowledge that it was wrong to punish Maori children for speaking in te reo rather than offering them a full apology. Race relations was also under the spotlight in the committee rooms, as Rhys Lyon reports.
On Wednesday, a petition calling on the government to revoke its classification of a sensitive parcel of land in Mangere as a special housing area, or SHA, fit for social housing development, was presented to the Social Services Committee. Speaking in support of the petition were representatives of the SOUL Save Our Unique Landscape group, with its aim outlined by a supporter, Panya Newton.
We support housing development, but we think that the area that has been proposed for this development is so significant that it needs to be preserved, and that the designation of a SHA on this area needs to be disestablished for the reasons that my colleagues will soon explain.
Those colleagues included retired archaeologist Dave Vert, who used an analogy to explain the land's significance.
What we're looking at here is the paddock next to Stonehenge. On one side of the fence, there's huge amounts of archaeological information. On the other side, we just don't know. And what concerns me is that it's the sort of area that is so important in terms of the history of this country that the SHA legislation is a very blunt instrument to try and deal with it. It's a place that needs a lot of examination. It needs people to sort of to look at it and make decisions where you're not operating under high pressure.
Also speaking in support of the petition was Mangere Bridge community leader Francis Hancock, who made a plea to the committee.
I'm 55 years old and I'm willing to beg Parliament, please hear us. Please advise the Minister that we are deeply concerned, that we want resolution, that we want to work constructively together. You know, we're not rabble-rousers. We're serious. We're professional. We're passionate. We're committed. We're just like you. We come with the same reasons you do, to represent your people over things that are so important. Please listen and respond to our requests.
That petition remains under consideration of the Social Services Committee. Also during the week, the government's Resource Legislation Amendment Bill, which makes changes to the Resource Management Act, or RMA, and aims to, quote, create a sustainable, efficient and equitable management system, unquote, for the country's natural resources, was up for public submissions to the Local Government and Environment Committee on Thursday. One of those submissions came from GE Free New Zealand President Claire Bleakley, who voiced concerns about the level of power the bill gives to ministers.
To dictate law to regions across a wide range of issues, these powers could be applied in ways that seriously undermine democratic process, community and stakeholder consultation and good governance. The bill would also create uncertainty for local authorities and undermine decision-making at a local level.
Ms. Bleakley said councils' power to make local decisions should not be diminished.
Councils are listening to their communities and they are saying we would like to place precautionary approaches to land use to preserve existing livelihoods and our premiums for a gene-free region. And at this stage, these proposals are opening up ministerial party politics that will interfere with the running of rural New Zealand yet again.
GE Free New Zealand President Claire Bleakley. And criticism of the bill also came from former National Party leader Don Brash, who set his sights squarely on the government.
It's incomprehensible to me how a National Party-led government could propose a bill which violates every principle of democratic governance, particularly when the party's own constitution lists among its values equal citizenship.
Dr. Brash explained how that related to the bill.
The RMA has long required local governments to consult with their community, and that is surely appropriate. Unfortunately, the RMA has also required local governments to additionally consult with Māori, as if Māori were somehow not part of the community. The bill now under discussion would vastly extend that preferential involvement for Māori. This is surely a recipe for further delay, for corruption, and for anger on the part of the rest of the community at what is the most flagrant breach of the basic principle of every democratic society, that all citizens should have the same legal rights.
Don Brash. The Resource Legislation Amendment Bill is due to be reported back to the Chamber by June the 3rd.
That report from Rhys Lyon. Back in the Chamber, Winston Peters managed to get himself thrown out of it twice, following arguments with the Speaker, David Carter. Firstly, on Wednesday...
I've ruled on that matter. If the member wishes to raise a fresh point of order, I'm very happy to hear it. But if any way I consider we're just going over old ground, litigating where we've been, then I will have no hesitation of asking that member to leave the chamber.
Mr Speaker, with point of order.
Point of order, the Right Honourable Winston
Peters. Mr Speaker, I am not going to let down the education system of this country by have you make it up as you go along. I'd rather leave the House than do that.
Well, the member's welcome then to leave the House. The member will leave the chamber.
Then on Thursday, when the Speaker lost patience with the length of one of the New Zealand First Leader's questions.
And the Prime Minister has said that the IRD has informed the Aussie authorities.
Order, can I have the supplementary question, please?
Well, you're getting it.
Well, I... Order, member will resume his seat. He will stand and apologise for that remark. I want him to ask supplementary questions in line with standing orders.
Point of order.
No, member will stand...
Well, I apologise.
Order!
I'm apologising.
Thank you.
Point of order.
Point of order.
Mr Speaker, right with the greatest of respect, I've been here longer than you and I know how to answer a question.
Order. Order. The member will leave the chamber.
While he was still in the debating chamber, Mr Peters teamed up with the Prime Minister for variations on his theme of prefacing his questions to Mr Key by asking him if he stands by all his previous statements. On Tuesday...
Mr Speaker, this question is to the Prime Minister. How does he stand by all his statements?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
On foot.
Brilliant, isn't it, eh?
Order.
Then on Wednesday...
Given his answer to question one yesterday, how does he stand by his statements?
The Right Honourable Prime
Minister. Mr Speaker, vertically.
Yeah, challenged.
Oh. And Winston Peters was not the only one wanting to pick a fight with the Speaker last week.
Point of order, the Honourable Gerry Brownlee.
Mr Speaker, I want to raise this matter now because it concerns the general sort of view around question time being a time when the opposition parties are able to hold a government to account.
The Leader of the House, Gerry Brownlee, getting in before the start of Wednesday's question time with a bone to pick with the Speaker, David Carter.
In particular, I want to talk about the question number three, which the government sought to transfer to the Minister of Revenue.
The transfer of questions between ministers is not unusual and is only disputed mainly when the opposition questioner objects, until Wednesday when, for the first time that I can recall, the objection came from the government, who'd wanted the question transferred for reasons explained by Mr Brownlee.
Mr Speaker, we did that on the basis that Speaker's rulings 1671, 1675 and 1765 all make it extremely clear that a question should be addressed to the Minister primarily responsible. Now that's a two-way street. Not only should it be primarily addressed to that Minister, but should also be answered by a Minister who can most reasonably provide the answer. Mr Speaker, in this case, the Minister of Finance has no direct responsibility for tax law. The question itself goes to the heart of tax law. Well, further, Mr Speaker, to those Speaker's rulings that I've mentioned, there is a number of rulings, 168, 1683, which prescribes pretty much how the official side of the House should deal with such questions. And what's concerning us, sir, is that in not allowing this transfer today, effectively 1671, 1675, 1683, 1684 and 1765 are swept aside. And I think, sir, it opens up the very fine line between an opposition party seeking information on a genuine basis to inform the public and simply making a political point. And it would be unfortunate, sir, if the new ruling that's bound to follow this decision today falls in favour of the latter. But, sir, I just record that we are very unhappy about this transfer. We do not believe it is in the best interests of the House and the people who should be informed by question time.
Mr Brownlee's argument drew an immediate response from the opposition MP who had lodged the question, Labor's finance spokesman, Grant Robertson.
To the point of order.
I will hear from Grant Robertson.
Mr Speaker, the matter raised in the question is about a specific report, the taxation of multinationals, dated the 15th of August 2013. I note that the recipient of that report is the Minister of Finance. The question, as fast as I've seen him move ever, the question was set down to the Minister of Finance asking whether or not he had read that report. He is the only person who can answer that question, whether or not he had read the report and whether he signed the recommendations. I do note that, in full disclosure, that the report also went to the Ministry of Revenue, but that is not the Ministry of Revenue we currently have. It was addressed to the Minister of Finance. He is the only person who can answer the question.
The Speaker invited one last comment from Mr Brownlee.
Well, Mr Speaker, responding to the comment by Mr Robertson, there are a lot of ministers who have correspondence addressed to them without the responsibility specifically attached to it. I think that is quite common. In the case, sir, of associate ministers receiving general correspondence about a particular portfolio, but not having that particular delegation. Mr Speaker, also I'd point out that the question being asked by Mr Robertson asks, did he undertake a particular course of action? That, sir, is the point where the ministerial responsibility is not exercised. The government has, I would hasten to point out, no problem answering this, very straightforward, but it is a principle of how transfers can be done in the future.
Mr Brownlee sat down to await the Speaker's verdict.
I thank members for their contribution. In quoting a number of Speaker's rulings, Mr Brownlee is correct in that in most cases it is the opportunity for the government to transfer questions where it feels that answer would be better given by the Minister for Primary Responsibility. In this case, I did invoke 1683 and not allow the transfer, because of the very specific nature of the question. The report to which members are alluding to, I have a copy of. It is a report prepared by IRD, Inland Revenue, and Treasury. It is clearly addressed to both ministers, and the recommendations that flow from the report were then to be signed by both ministers. Mr. Robinson's question does not want to know whether Mr. Woodhouse, as the Minister of Revenue, received and read the report. He quite specifically wants to know whether Mr. English received and read the report and then took action with the recommendations. Because it is a joint report to both ministers, I determined that the only person who could satisfactorily answer the question that Mr. Robinson has raised was the Minister of Finance, and on that basis, I did not allow the transfer.
The Speaker, David Carter, while Gerry Brownley went on to pick another fight the next day, as Rhys Lyon reports.
Following question time on Thursday afternoon, MPs undertook debate on this year's budget allocations for the Offices of Parliament. Those are the Auditor-General, the Commissioner for the Environment, and the Office of the Ombudsman. Launching the debate was Leader of the House, Gerry Brownley, who raised some eyebrows around the chamber with the comments he made about the new Ombudsman towards the end of his speech.
I would make this one comment, though, Mr. Speaker, and I've thought very long and hard about making it, because it's not always appropriate for this House to express views about independent commissioners who are basically the people who lead the organisations we're speaking about today. But I did see an interview on television on the 19th of March with the Chief Ombudsman that I thought did have one or two matters raised and suggestions made by the Chief Ombudsman that should cause us all a concern. The Ombudsman's role is to make sure that people are treated fairly inside our democracy, not to determine the bounds of that democracy. Nor, sir, is it the role of the Ombudsman to start determining what a relationship should be, for example, between a client and a legal representative, a lawyer, etc. Nor should they stray into areas that are most appropriately dealt with by the courts, particularly when it comes to the rules that allow us to live a free life in a country like this. I know that that is possibly a fine line, but that interview gave me quite some cause for concern.
And those comments from the Leader of the House gave Labor's Trevor Mallard cause for concern.
The last comments made by the Leader of the House have caused me to divert substantially from the comments that I was going to make. The first thing I want to do is to congratulate Mr. Speaker on the good work that he does chairing the Offices of Parliament Committee and the way that he builds unanimity around both the appropriation and the appointment process. And to have Gerry Brownley, the Leader of the House, criticise the fine legal brain of the new Ombudsman, as he just did when he said he was concerned.
That's where Mr. Brownley interrupted with a point of order.
Point of order, the Honourable Gerry Brownley.
There is a procedure in standing orders that would allow me to make a comment about that right
no,
now.
No,
I won't. All I'll say is I made no such accusation.
Appears to be a matter for debate.
Mr. Mallard defended his commentary of Mr. Brownlee's speech.
He did say he was concerned about the criticism, about the comments of the Chief Ombudsman. That is what he said. And, sir, that when the Leader of this Parliament, the Leader of the House in this Parliament, indicates that about the Ombudsman, it is something which causes me concern, because we are meant to be behind the Ombudsman, is very recently appointed. I think the member himself might have moved the nomination. Certainly it was moved from his office. Sir, it is a fine appointment.
Trevor Mallard said he fully endorsed the appointment of the new Ombudsman.
I want to say, with the Chief Ombudsman saying, that he will do two things. He will talk to members of Parliament from all parties about the shape of their requests and help them make them more reasonable and easier to answer. And he will insist on the standards of the law being met by government departments and by ministers, and he will report to this House on this, and I think that is a damn fine thing. And to see anxiety on the part of the Leader of the House for an Ombudsman who is going to line up with the law, who this Parliament is now going to give the resource to get him to do his job properly, to attack the backlog, to do really innovative things.
Really innovative things, such as...
like using the phone to help sort disputes out, something which was not part of the practice in the past, to use something really innovative like using emails to sort problems out, which apparently the leader of the House does not like. I think it is a good thing.
Also taking issue with Mr Brownlee's speech was Green MP Eugenie Sage.
Like the previous speaker, I'm extremely troubled by the comments of the Leader of the House. In this call, I was going to congratulate the Office of Parliament Select Committee for finally responding to the request by the Office of the Ombudsman for increased resources. And I think the comprehensive review that the former Ombudsman, Chief Ombudsman Dame Beverley Wakeham did of 12 selected government agencies, a survey she did of ministers' offices, and the look at how the Act was being implemented elsewhere, showed that the major problem was not in the law itself, in the Official Information Act, but the way it was being implemented in the execution. And I think my memory of the interview with the new Chief Ombudsman was that he was simply pointing out that there were people in government agencies who were qualified in the law, therefore were in a position to understand very clearly what the Official Information Act meant, and that should assist in better execution of that Act.
Ms Sage underlined the important role played by the Ombudsman's office.
They are absolutely critical in providing openness and transparency in our democracy, in balancing the rights of the citizen against the much larger powers of the state, in ensuring that government ministers and government departments are accountable. And I can only commend the work that the former Chief Ombudsman and the new Chief Ombudsman are doing in improving the way in which the Official Information Act is implemented.
The motion confirming the budgets of the Offices of Parliament was eventually endorsed by all parties, the Ombudsman's Office receiving a boost in its annual funding by around $2.5 million.
That report from Rhys Lyon. And now a final word from Mr Brownlee as Leader of the House with a preview of this week in the House in his weekly business statement last Thursday.
Mr Speaker, when the House resumes on Tuesday the 12th of April, the Government will look to make progress on the taxation, residential land withholding tax, GST on online services and student loans bill, the annual review debate and a number of other bills on the order paper.
And has become the norm recently, Mr Brownlee's opposition shadow, Labor's Chief Whip Chris Hipkins, noticed something missing from his business statement.
Chris Hipkins. I wonder whether the Leader of the House could inform us whether it is still the Government's intention to extend the sitting on Wednesday into Thursday.
Honourable Gerry Brownlee.
Mr Speaker, it is indeed the Government's intention. In fact, it is the Business Committee's intention, and I thought it was not worth repeating something that clearly the Member would have told us other members is actually happening on that day. But there will be three bills debated that particular day. They are all settlement bills, following what is becoming quite, a positive pattern in the House to use extended sittings to achieve those particular results.
The Leader of the House, Gerry Brownlee, I'm Tom Frewin, and this program was brought to you with funding from Parliament.